Hey there, Dragonfly Nation. I wanted to announce a very big event happening in the summer of 2022. I want to give you this information now in the winter time so that you have time to prepare for this, because this is a big deal. The 2022 Global Bushcraft Symposium has been announced. It is going to be happening from July 27th to the 31st of July in the year 2022. It is being co-chaired by Lisa Fenton and Paul Kirtley, names that you should be well aware of, folks, especially if you're all into the bushcraft world. Speakers are including Dr. Teresa Camper, Bruce Zawalski, Gordon Dedman, Patrick McGlinchey, and Rupert Brown. These and many others are why I'm excited. These are some of the greatest brains of today when it comes down to woodcraft, survival, indigenous ancestral skills, anything you can think of. We're in the realm of bushcraft. It is happening at this event. And it's happening in Wales, United Kingdom, in July 27th to the 31st in the year 2022. So pack your stuff up now, get it all ready, get your passport in order, get all the stuff you need in order, because this is going to be a very big event, very, very big event that I am excited to be going to with Rye the Adventure Guy. We may even record a few podcasts with some folks while we're there. Hope to see you there this coming summer from July 27th to July 31st. If you want to learn more, go to www.globalbushcraftsymposium2022.com. Again, www.globalbushcraftsymposium2022.com.
To know the landscape is to open up a door, to feel deeper connected than you've ever felt before. We know that you will love this podcast. So shut your mouth and listen to Canadian Bushcraft.
Hey there, folks. It's Caleb and Rye again. We're here to talk about cast iron. Cast iron pots and pans, it's classic.
Cauldrons for cauldrons. Maple syrup.
Oh, heck yeah. Griddle tops and flat tops and everything else like that for car camping with the grandparents or the grandkids.
Baking. Oh, any use, yeah. Broiling.
It's such a,
beat it up.
Yeah, it's a really great piece of equipment. There's a lot of different, you know, reasons to carry cast iron or use cast iron. I think the two places that it doesn't fit is long distance canoe camping and backpacking. But pretty much in any other scenario, if you're doing like lake tripping on canoes, take some cast iron with you. If you're going out on a car camping trip, or you're doing a back, like an overland trip with either horses, you know, llamas, pack mules, whatever it may be, or with a vehicle, yeah, take the cast iron. If you have a, if you got a base camp or a hunt camp,
or even if you've got like a small 8-inch skillet,
and that's the next thing, is going into that,
the biggest issue to carry it, if it's something that this is my, I cook my best meals on this pan. I feel like it's a luxury, but we all kind of play that game with what can I go with, what can I go without,
what do I want to have
on trips. So if you're doing a long canoe trip and you're out there for like 2 months and you want to have the best meals, some people might take the backpacking foods and freeze dried packets of whatever and MREs. But if this is the one thing that makes you wake up in the morning and get ready to like push yourself 60 kilometers plus in a day for a canoe trip sort of thing,
do it up.
Then go for it. As long as you kind of account for that. Maybe I won't take this extra little thing, but I'll bring my cast iron. And they're so, some of them are so small that you can cook for one or two people.
And there's even like, we have a cast iron wok that we have at the camp.
Yeah.
That is like paper thin and that doesn't weigh a lot. It was really difficult for me to believe that that was cast iron when I first got it, because it felt like a carbon steel wok in weight. So why do we use cast iron? Why do people even want to be taking cast iron with them in the backcountry for any reason? What are some reasons in your eyes that you really appreciate having cast iron?
I love the fact that you can cook over a campfire, pretty low maintenance on it. Like there is maintenance on it, but in general, when you do the work up front and make sure you have taken care of it, given it what it needs, seasoned it properly, and then as well as the fact when you're cooking on coals, it evenly disperses the heat.
Yeah, it's and there's like some really cool research into that, like cast iron, other metals and other cookware that we have. How do they actually, you know, conduct the heat and absorb the heat? The best is copper, flat out. You can't really beat copper. It's an even conductor. That's why we use it for wiring. But cast iron, it evenly heats slowly. And that's really where it becomes really beautiful, is it takes a while for it to heat up, but it doesn't flash burn. Like, you're not going to scorch a meal. You're going to sear steak for sure if you want to, but it's going to build that up over time. It's an even heat over time.
On the flip side of that, though, it does take a while to cool down. So if you overheat it,
yeah.
I don't necessarily like it for stuff like sauteing. No. I like something where I can nicely, easily control it. But at the same time, if you do have it over an open fire on the coals and you notice it's getting a little hot, then just take it off and it's still going to be cooking. It's not within like your typical aluminum pans or stainless steel, where all of a sudden you take it right off the burner and all of a sudden it's
cold.
It's slightly sizzling and then it's like not cooking anymore.
Cast iron is that beautiful, like, and it's, there's a reason that cast iron is what the majority of Dutch ovens or camp ovens are made out of, is because you can evenly heat with open flame, with coals, and it holds that heat at an even rate. It's not going to, you know, you heat the, like the left, I want to say corner, but most of cast iron is round, but like the left side, and suddenly the right side is gonna be the exact same heat, even though it's not over the fire, but the whole pan is going to warm up and be hot. And you have like little hot spots where you need to sear something a little bit more, and you can move it off to the side where it's a little cooler and you can keep cooking it through evenly. Like, it's great for steak. I like,
there's a lot of versatility. That's what I love about it. You can, so many different styles.
Mm-hmm.
As well as what you can cook in each of them.
Totally.
Like, even if you just bring a cast iron Dutch oven, you've got the main body, the pot, cooking stews in that. You can even, with a lot of the ones that you just flip over the lid, and that turns into a skillet itself.
Totally. There's so many different, and like talking about versatility, there's also, as you bring up, variety.
Yeah.
You can have really tiny. I have one that's literally the size of, like, I'd say 3.5-4 inches across.
Yeah.
That's like the perfect for making like one egg.
Mm-hmm.
And it's perfect for that. And then you can get 12-inch or 8-inch frying pans or skillets. And then you've got Dutch ovens. You've got deep dish Dutch ovens. You've got Dutch ovens that have legs and bales. You've got Dutch ovens that just have handles, like what you use on a stovetop or in an oven. There's so many options available. And I think that's something that's really fascinating, really cool. When you're looking at, like, you know, titanium, there's only so many ways they're going to make a cook pot. If you're talking about aluminum, there's only so many ways to make a skillet out of it. And
it's going to be a lot more touchy trying to do the more advanced things like baking and trying to bake a loaf of bread.
Yeah.
And something that you're going to most likely burn the bottom out of that loaf of bread if you're using a stainless steel pot for that.
Yeah.
You can do it, but you have to, it's a lot higher maintenance while watching it, making sure you're keeping at a steady temperature where it's not too much. Whereas you can let your hair down a little more with cast iron, but at the same time, keep checking it once in a while.
It's dependable.
And the fact that you can pile the coals on the lid itself for a Dutch oven. So.
Have we done a Dutch oven cookout at the camp with you yet? When I bring out like all my toys?
I remember that one time we did the one February course, the wild deer you brought out, and we had chicken and wild rice and everything.
Yeah.
So we've done a few things, and then most recently with the Dutch oven when Peter Kelly was over.
And we were sugaring with it.
And boiling it down.
And of course, the cauldrons we have at the camp. So for those of you, of course, you're probably aware that we do sugar bush here at Canadian Bushcraft. And for the last month, we've been boiling out of two cauldrons that are cast iron. And they're antique cast iron. And that's another kind of beautiful thing about cast iron, is it's kind of timeless.
I think if any other pot got the work those two cauldrons have got, with the heat of those flames that we've got going, enough to incinerate, I think anything else would have warped and got hot spots and blown out in certain spots.
Melted even.
But those things have gone for decades and they're still ticking.
And we use those same cauldrons. Like, you and I have gone doing rice processing with that cauldron. And then we've done at least two seasons now boiling in that pot. Mm-hmm. And that's a hand-me-down. Like, those cauldrons are hand-me-downs of mine and Keith's, from relatives and friends who had them before us that did sugaring and rice processing and cooking corn and everything else in them. Cast iron is, as long as you don't break it, it's timeless. If the season's gone bad, it's got rusty, strip it. We'll talk about how to do that later in the episode.
Well, that's the thing that even brought us here was those three pieces I found in the backyard there in the tarp shelter that had at least an eighth of an inch of rust.
At least.
Every single part was just covered in rust. Mm-hmm. So I was like, ooh. My mind started ticking when I saw those. It's like, I can make those back into what they were like when they were new. Anything else, I'm like, it's a little past. It's a $20 pan.
Yeah.
But with the, especially with the cost of cast iron, they're expensive pieces for the most part.
Even like some used can get pretty expensive.
So turning those back into usable pieces is money in your pocket you spent a while ago, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I did it. I posted photos and I got 45 comments talking about how satisfactory it was seeing them go from rust buckets to brand new, nice and black again.
Legit. They looked like they came right out of the box. They were you did an amazing job on
those. It just shows what a little TLC can do for your camping gear. And it's something, it was therapeutic. It was hard on my hands. I still have cuts and scratches and all the rust is under my fingernails. Maybe wear some rubber gloves while doing it or something. It's a
good recommendation.
But yeah, it's satisfying once you get that done and you're like, yes.
Yeah. I think for me, like where cast iron really shines, I'm a foodie. I'm a nerd when it comes down to food. I love it for like searing food. Like again, getting back to like building up a crust on a steak or getting the sear for like an ossobuco or something like that and braising. Mm-hmm. Like when you're slow cooking in an oven or slow cooking over the fire.
Yeah.
Using a cast iron pot, which has got a nice fitting lid on it. It makes the best corn soup. It makes the best pulled pork. It makes the best ribs. It makes the best ossobuco. Mm-hmm. It just tastes better coming out of that. And it cooks them so well. I think there's like four pots or pans in my entire collection that are not cast iron.
Yeah.
Everything else in this house is pretty much cast iron. And if I had a propane, when we moved to the new place with a propane stove, I'm getting rid of everything that's not cast iron. Because that's where cast iron really shines in the household is over a propane stove. It's okay on a glass top or electric stove. But it really shines with a propane. And in the woods, propane gas stoves, wood burning stoves, wood fire, open coals. Mm-hmm. I think the only thing I wouldn't put on top of is an alcohol stove just because of the kind of Goliath of a task there to try and heat that up with that alcohol.
It's also a little weary putting them on some of those gas stoves because you get the gas cylinder and you get the stove and sometimes that's 10 to 12 inches off the ground. And it's just like a 4-inch balancing disc point to balance it on.
Yeah.
And especially when you load that up with food and how heavy it is all by itself, let alone once you've loaded it up with whatever you're cooking.
But that's where I like to use like the local area. So I'll stack up flat rocks and I'll build up almost not a tripod, but more like a couple of walls around my gas stove and put my, my Dutch oven on top of that or my frying pan. You can do things like that. I know some guys that drive green wooden sticks into the ground and make kind of like a tripod or pegs underneath it. There's a whole lot of different ways to try and, you know, make that feel safer.
You can make it work, but just the usual way I do it is over the fire. Yeah. If I'm using cast iron out in the woods, I'm not going to bring over my little rinky dinky Primus stove. It might be a little easier on something like a Dragonfly or that's Coleman. Set on the ground or a Coleman stove. Because I was what I grew up with going on camping trips and the parents bring out the cast iron skillet slash griddle. So that was always something fun to have. And it can work that way. I just don't necessarily trust it on top.
On like a jet boil or something. I wouldn't want to try that.
Something like that. Yeah.
Totally. I get you there. And there's, you know, a lot of like mystique around the cast iron. It's it dates back to the 5th century BC in China. Like it's been around for a long time. When we talk about it's timeless equipment, it's genuinely timeless equipment. And the way it's made, the term cast iron is talking about what's going on. You have all this iron in a furnace, sometimes in a big crucible, sometimes in the old days, it could have been a much smaller crucible. And then it was cast into sand molds. And so when you get that cast iron pot or pan right from, like, let's say you got one from like Lodge, the most popular, well-known brand of cast iron out there is Lodge brand. And you feel that texture, that's the outer edges of sand. That's what the surface is. They may polish it up a little bit with grinders to clean off like the big chunks of slag and stuff that might be stuck on there, or mm-hmm. sprues, but that is what your cast iron is made out of, is sand. Iron poured into sand. It has not changed. We've changed how we configure the sand for molds, but we're still using sand like mm-hmm. we have for thousands of years now. The problem that we get into when it comes down to like how cast iron works is the weight, and people start to get kind of sketchy about like all these rules they've heard about cast iron. Mm-hmm. Don't use metal utensils mm-hmm. in your cast iron. Don't ever wash your cast iron, especially not with soap. Never mm-hmm. put soap in there. You'll hear things like, you can't do this, you can't do that. You have to use this type of oil. You have to do this kind of thing. On the third full moon of the year, you must dance naked with your cast iron counterclockwise.
You tell me all those times are a waste.
No comment.
There's awkward pause.
Awkward pause. Awkward pause number two. When it comes down to it, there's a lot of almost like old wives' tales about cast iron. And that's because old timers, you know, they set up how they have it. They have their cast iron how they want. It was a different time back then, literally and figuratively. Back then, soap was made with lye.
Yeah.
And lye is what we use to strip cast iron. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't want to put that soap on your cast iron. Nowadays, we don't even have phosphates in most of our detergents.
Yeah.
It's very mild. You can wash it. Just make sure you rinse it thoroughly. There's all these things that scare people. So Ryan pitched this idea of an episode, and I was like, this is a great idea. How important cast iron is to everybody for their camp experience, but also, let's be honest, for their Instagram. Like, you had 45 mm-hmm. people message you mm-hmm. about that post, because everybody in bushcraft is all about the cast iron life, mm-hmm. I think. And so let's talk about this. Let's dive into this. Let's get into like how to help you, dear listener, become more of the cast iron clan. So before we go any further, just as a heads up, I'm noticing we're having some sound here. We're in the same room where our goslings are brooding. So you'll hear, you'll hear cheeping, probably some sloshing around as they're getting into their water. So if you hear some noise in the background, don't worry, you're not going crazy. It's here with us. So on the subject of cast iron and why we love it and everything else, how do we help these folks find some stuff for themselves?
It's all about where to look.
Mm-hmm.
You can find them at flea markets, garage sales, secondhand stores and thrift shops.
Antique shops.
Anywhere I think they have some old-timey equipment,
you'll find some cast
iron. Is where I look.
Yeah. You can also look on things like Kijiji, Craigslist, Marketplace on Facebook, things like that as well. Just type in cast iron, and it'll usually pop up. You'll see something going on.
Even Caleb's backyard. We find cast iron back there too and make it look brand new. So.
Yes, exactly. So there's all that. You can also buy new.
Yeah.
You can buy new. There's brands like Lodge that are out there that make cast iron pretty much the same way they have for a century now in these big industrial refractory systems and stuff. Very, very good stuff. They're good quality cast iron. Be mindful that, and I had this talk with Ben Bouchard years back, and I think we talked about it again before we did our last podcast with him. The newer cast iron that's made today is not at the same quality on fit and finish. It's still in the same quality of iron. Mm-hmm. The iron is still good. It's just not as smooth because they aren't taking the time to grind away all the lines and blemishes as much as they used to. So a lot of your cast iron that comes from something like Lodge or Lagostina, you'll see a lot of pitting on the inside of your frying pan. And that's again, like I was talking about earlier about how they make it, that's actually the mold from the sand. So if you want to get even smoother, either buy used, old antique ones are much smoother. Like I have a Wagner that's at least 60 years old in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. It's like glass. Yeah. It is so smooth. And that's, you know, the seasoning helps that as well.
Well, I was about to say, even the seasoning is meant to fill those pores. Mm-hmm. And give you a nice glossy finish sort of thing.
Yeah. And that's if you're getting a newer cast iron and you don't know where you don't want to ruin it, just make more and more seasonings. And eventually it'll fill those pores up. If you do one or two seasonings, maybe not. But by the fifth or sixth coating, Yeah, it'll fill those up pretty
easily. Companies like Lodge will claim they do their pre-seasoning and factory and everything, but I still go and season it like I would any other piece that I got from home, got it from garage sale, got from my grandparents, anything like that. So, yeah.
So the big benefit of new is it's not going to come with cracks or dents or somebody, God forbid, painted it.
At least then you could get a factory warranty or such like that. So they have to live up to their standard. If something was missed on the factory line, then okay, you can call them and be like, yo, what's up? This is broken. Why did you sell this to me?
Yeah. You get a 100-year-old piece and it's cracked. You can't really call them up.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
Who made this? Oh, it was some guy named Schwartz.
Obadiah. You got to get a hold of this. You got to do a seance.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the main benefit of new is it's new. It's brand new. And there's still like decent quality cast iron coming out. Like again, Lodge isn't bad. We actually found out from Lars Hedin about 2 weeks ago, almost a month ago now, actually, when I think about it. Carolina Cookers.
Yeah.
The company Carolina Cookers. They're made in China, but the sand in the Chinese molds is a finer sand. So you have a lot smaller pores to deal with in the first place. And they're actually fairly inexpensive.
Yeah.
I was checking out their prices. If you went to get a 40 or 50 gallon cast iron cauldron, like what we're using at the Sugar Bush right now, antique can go as high as $1,000.
Yeah.
Even though they're antique and old, they can still be that expensive. Brand new 90 gallon from Carolina Cookers is $550 American.
Yeah.
Which is like 700 Canadian, give or take. Still lower than an antique.
Yeah.
So like there's nothing wrong with like Chinese made cast iron. People make all these kinds of claims about poorly made cast iron. Yeah, there is some out there.
It's not something you're finding at a dollar store anyway. That's mostly when the problems come with Chinese made things is when it's not made to last.
Exactly.
Whereas a cast iron, it's made to last.
The Chinese have been making cast irons longer than anyone else. Like they know what cast iron is supposed to be.
Yeah.
They get that. That's in their wheelhouse, culturally, nationally, all that stuff.
And even up, it's up to the buyer's discretion in the first place to make sure you're buying something of quality and not just blindly, oh, it says cast iron, so I'm buying that first. Do your research, read your reviews, make sure there's no other problems. Oh, yeah, all these fake comments on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the most liked one with 300 likes. This was helpful. That is like, nope, it blew up. Shrapnel killed my dog. This is what happened to it.
Just picturing a skillet exploding. What's going on? Anyways, there's like, you got to do your research. And when it comes down to antiques, the same thing. There's a lot of websites. There's a lot of forums. There's a lot of Facebook groups about cast iron. And if you see, you can find a list of like well-made used cast iron brands, and if you see that, like, have that in the back of your head, go antiquing with your spouse or your partner or a buddy of yours. Ryan and I, we got to go antiquing more.
Yeah.
Now that everything's starting to open up more, we can
go antiquing. Exactly. Everything's been closed for the last two years, so
we were talking about going to like flea markets yesterday. Like, oh, I want to go, but keep it in the back here, like Wagner, of course, Lodge. Lagostinas aren't bad. I find them a lot more porous than the Lodge ones are. They have seemed to have bigger pores, but they're not bad. But if you're looking at like old antique, look for those name brands of like Wagner, Black Diamond, all those kinds of names. And when you find one, oh, I know this name. I've heard of these before. Yeah. Clearly, if I remember the name, it must be a good one.
Well, it's even a few I have, I think. It just says Agent Skillet Taiwan on it.
Yep.
And then, like, when I looked it up on Google, it's just like only eBay sellers sell it. Mm-hmm. It's an antique, so I'm not sure. You might just find ones where you have no idea where tracing the origins of its make. So
it becomes its own little like scavenger hunter, little detective work you got to do. Mm-hmm. And then of course, if we're looking at used, because there's a lot of used, and often used cast iron is a lot less expensive than new. Not always, sometimes it's more. But you can find like at like a thrift store or like a Salvation Army or, well, that's a thrift store, antique shops. You can see all these cast irons going up. pick them up. They sometimes can range from anywhere from $5 to $50, depending on what you're looking at.
Yeah, I would say be a little weary about shopping places like Value Village. Value Village is already under a little bit of flack with their label price. It'll have the original label saying $12 on there, and they're selling for $22. So just be smart when you're shopping.
Yep.
Because I see that a lot in thrift shops. You expect to go in there and find a deal on cast iron, and it's still the $50 it was when it was brand new.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I just might as well go to Canadian Tire and get that same one. So.
Totally. So what should we be looking for? It really comes, first thing is like, what do you want? What are you looking for? If you're looking for a skillet that is 10 inches or 12 inches or what have you, don't stop and look too hard at like the roasting pans. Mm-hmm. Know what you're there to get, know what you're looking for, do a little bit of research on what they're usually valued at, and then know what the quality should be like. If there's big seam cracks, if there's really bad pitting where you can see like it's almost a quarter inch thinner at a certain spot from rust many years ago, and they just kind of coated that over with some oil and tried to cover it up.
Mm-hmm.
Broken like bales, things like that, be aware of those things. The number one thing that I warn people about when it comes down to antique or used cast iron is paint. So many people paint, like, these are the people that and you all know that I try to be a nice person, but these are the people that deserve to step on a piece of Lego while falling into traffic. People who paint cast iron, there's a special ring in hell for them, in my opinion. Because A, why'd you do this?
It's like the people who just spray paint over the rust on their car.
Yeah. Yeah. Painting them does not do anything other than seal the rust in. It doesn't stop the rust. It doesn't do anything. It just makes it look pretty on the outside. But also, it is nigh on impossible to remove. And you can't, like, we bought way back when I first started getting into using cast iron for the sugar bush. I bought these 4 or 5 cast iron cauldrons that were, I don't know, 2-3 gallons. Like, they were small, let's be honest, they were tiny. The ones we have there are 45 gallons.
Yeah.
Big difference. But they were great, but one of them just stunk, and I brought it home. I was like, maybe the seasoning has gone bad. Scrubbed it as hard as I could. I put in a vinegar solution, we'll be talking about that later, for stripping the seasoning and everything else and any rust and all that. Left it there for like 2 days and it was still black. I'm like, this is strange, maybe I gotta burn this off. So I put it in a barbecue, got that barbecue as hot as possible, and I smelled burning paint, and it dawned on me what's going on. Somebody had painted this entire pot to stay black, and then
even the inside too?
Yeah, the whole thing was black.
Maybe just hit the outside of the barbecue paint or something.
The whole thing was painted. It was a high heat paint
that
I couldn't take off completely, no matter how hard I tried. I talked to a bunch of different people who are more proficient with cast iron restoration than me, and they're like, get rid of it. You can't say that. Even if you take a wire wheel with paint stripper, and the type of paint stripper you would need would be even worse for you than the paint is already. And you have to use a wire wheel and all this stuff. By the time you were done, you still wouldn't be able to use that cast iron because the pores have absorbed the paint inside. And every time you cook, the pores open up a little bit and more of the stuff comes back into the liquid.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the beauty of cast iron is, if you keep seasoning it and you're cooking in between, you don't completely wipe out all the residue of, like, let's say your tacos from the night before, you can kind of use that flavoring the next day to make like spicy burrito breakfast.
Just hit it with some kosher salt, give it a good rub.
Yeah.
And then you're good to go. Maybe even throw
it
in the oven a little bit.
Yeah. But if it's paint, every meal is going to have that paint taste. Mm-hmm. And who knows what was in that paint to begin with. So we had to get rid of it. And I came across 10 more in my time. Really? Since then, trying to find old cauldrons and stuff, old cast iron. Do not paint cast iron.
A little work goes a long way. Some people just want to cover up the blemishes and sell it as quick as possible, because cast iron is the hot topic, the in thing for cooking these days. So people are looking to turn a quick buck and not willing to put in even 2 hours of work to restore it. So
don't do that. And also be mindful of that. If it smells like paint or looks like it's been painted, walk away. If you have any suspicion that this thing's been painted, walk away. Don't risk your health. Don't risk your mental health trying to clean it. Walk away. Someone else somewhere else has cast iron for you. Don't worry.
Although a well-seasoned pan can, to the untrained eye, give off a very glossy black finish. Yep.
And that's what we're looking for.
Yeah.
That's what we're looking for in cast iron.
So you not necessarily might not know that it has been painted, or you might see that good seasoning and think it has been painted, sort of thing. So just be aware.
Be mindful. That's what I was like. The number one giveaway is smell. It's going to smell, and you're going to notice that it seems like it's got like kind of a drip across the pores. Like the pores, it's kind of like when you have that really porous wall and somebody paints on like a wooden wall, and you have like those little lines of paint that go across, like little bridges across the grain. You'll see that on the pores, and you know it's been painted. Like, just do your due diligence, be the detective.
If there's any flakiness to it.
Yeah. So, and from there, like, what else are we looking for? Of course, again, cracks. If you find like a Dutch oven that's got legs, check to make sure all three legs are attached still.
Yeah.
Sometimes one of them breaks off and it's not fully broken. You don't know that until you try to cook a meal in there and have the whole thing fall over on you. Check the bales. The bale on my current Dutch oven that we have at the camp, I'm a little annoyed at. The bale is not working as it's supposed to.
Yeah.
I got to swap that one out soon with some stiff, thick steel wire. Whatever it may be, there's always the possibility that you can repair or refurbish, and we'll be getting into that in a moment.
If it's a Dutch oven, make sure the lid fits well.
Yeah, or there's a lid.
Yeah.
Many times I found this beautiful Dutch oven at an antique shop, and there ain't no lid. And then the cool thing, though, is that, like, if you find a Dutch oven or a big cast iron pot that doesn't have a lid, don't fret. Buy it anyways if it's a good, if it's a well-known brand. Like, if you find a Lodge Dutch oven or a Lodge cook pot, like the big stew pots that they make, buy it anyways because they sell lids.
Yeah,
you can buy a lid, and if you look around enough, it's like, oh, this has a 20-inch, it's a pretty big one, but let's say 20-inch pot. It's not Lodge, but the lid fits.
Yeah,
like you can find companies that make the lids as well for their accoutrements of their, or their accessories for their, for their cast iron products. Don't be afraid. And honestly, like, if it doesn't have a lid, you can still use a pot. Just find a lid that kind of works.
Yeah.
You won't be able to use it as a Dutch oven, but use it as a cook pot. Still don't get any problems with that.
If the price is right.
Yeah. Yeah. If you got a $15 pot that's like a 1 gallon, it doesn't have a lid, who cares? I'll take a piece of wood, slap it on top. But yeah, there's a lot of things to look out for. Other things you would want to think of looking at?
I think also make sure what the intended use is. If it's made to just go in an oven in your home, sort of thing. Because there are some that are coated and painted on the outside and everything with food safe paints and everything. Yep. But they're you can tell by them, they don't have the features that an outdoor cast iron from the outdoor backcountry uses tend to be just
bare iron. Yeah.
They'll have the feet. So in case you put them over coals, you don't want to have those feet if you're trying to slide it into an oven or anything like that. And they'll have the bale wires and everything like that. So
we've as an example, I own four Dutch ovens from Lodge. One of them is ceramic coated.
Yeah.
The purple one I take out all the time for meals. And I use that because we're doing pasta sauce and stuff, something that's going to be extremely acidic. And I don't really want to fight with my seasoning the whole time.
Exactly.
But then we have like another big one that's got no feet on it. That's a solid bare cast iron. Then we have the two with the legs and the bales. Those two go to the camp. Those ones go camping with us. And so you can get coated ones that are ceramic. Sometimes, again, they have the food safe paint jobs.
Yeah.
Some do like an enamel coating on them and stuff. The weirdest one I saw was about 3 years ago. There was a company, I don't know who it was. I can't remember their name. They were selling Teflon coated cast iron.
Really?
The most redundant, stupid thing I've ever heard of in my life.
Buzzwords.
Yeah. Like if you season your cast iron right and you've got good quality cast iron to begin with, and you season it well, and even if it's kind of shoddy cast iron, it's like the Taiwanese stuff you don't have a real name for, but you season it really well and you take care of it really well.
Yeah.
You don't need Teflon. It's better than Teflon because it's not going to kill you. You're adding
your own Teflon coating.
Yeah.
An old natural Teflon, the original Teflon.
A Teflon that won't make you sick later on.
And then even then, you can do your own modifications to anything. I've seen some of those Dutch ovens where those three legs on the bottom are way too long. and have no real use. You want it just enough that you can squeeze some coals underneath mm-hmm. it, and that's it. Any longer, it can make it tippy.
Yep.
Especially if you're trying to balance it on something else.
Soft and ground.
Sit it on something. Yeah, one leg might dig into the deep ground. One's sitting on a rock. So then all of a sudden, you're having your whole dinner fall over the place. So you can even just take a grinding wheel and cut them snip off it down to make them shorter. Or some people just cut them off altogether.
One guy, he cut it shorter, but because of the whole soft ground thing that he couldn't stand, he welded 2-inch washers onto his feet.
Yeah.
To just spread the weight out mm-hmm. better. I thought that was a brilliant idea.
I do the same thing for like camping chairs and yep. stuff. A lot of the folding Helinox chairs and everything, adding some tennis balls to the bottom, something that's not going to let it dig into the ground.
Totally.
So yeah, be handy.
Hell yeah. There's so many different directions you can go with modifications. I'm currently hating the bale that's on my Dutch oven because it's not working the way it's supposed to. It keeps wanting to tip when we're trying to pour things or carry food around. I'm considering just getting a chain and attaching a small chain to it, because that way, A, the bale's not always going to get in the way and get stuck and snagged like this one hasn't getting twisted. It's just chain, but it also, you can find its sweet spot to hang from practically anything.
I think preferably a chain that's removable with a good heavy duty rings on the end that you can screw on and off, because it is a kind of a pain in the butt whenever you're not using it. You're not hanging it from anywhere and you just got a loose chain dangling down the side into the coals and everything. Totally. And now I can't pick it up because it's burning hot. So.
Yeah. There's a lot of things you can do to modify. I know some guys, so the one Dutch oven I have, that's the big, heavy black cast iron that goes in the oven here at the house or on the stove. The lid doesn't have that smooth griddle top. It has those dripper rings. And that's what those rings, if you ever see a cast iron lid that's got these rings or like these studs that look like it's for something like in an Iron Maiden in the medieval times, those are drippers. That's to make all the stuff that's condensing on the lid drip back into your food. That's why it's so good at braising, is it's very efficient at keeping the moisture in. Some guys really like that, and they don't like having that griddle top, that smooth griddle top. And so they'll just take an angle grinder and just kind of put a checker mark on there to make things condense and drip. Vice versa, people who really want to have that griddle top, they had to go with that size model of Dutch oven. That model only comes with a dripper lid. Angle grinder with a flap disc, and they just ground them all smooth until the whole surface was nice, one smooth surface.
Well, so you get some of the lids that just have your typical D-shaped handle on top, and then there's other ones I've seen where they actually have feet on the top of the lid.
Yeah.
So when you do flip it over to use as a griddle, then it's stable. Have the feet again, and you have that space underneath to evenly space some coals and everything. So it's different features like that to look for your intended use. If you tend to just bring this one cast iron Dutch oven and it's your frying pan, your pot, your everything.
It does everything you need.
Yeah. Those are just extra features to look for.
Definitely. Another option for cast iron pots, if you may want to have them out there with you, is like your chicken cooker. The cast iron chicken cooker where the lid is a skillet.
Yeah.
And so you have a deep saucepan with a long handle, and you've got a skillet with a long handle that attach to each other.
Yeah.
You have a Dutch oven, a skillet, and a cook pot, saucepan, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. If you're not worrying about hanging it off a pot hanger, the long handles are just fine.
Those ones don't typically, like the weight would all be thrown off for suspending those over anything. So
I wouldn't recommend
it. I do like those styles though, where it's like pretty much a skillet flipped over on top of a pot.
Mm-hmm.
Just the two handles, good to go.
Totally. There's a lot of options out there. If you go onto Lodge's website, you go on, like, again, cast iron collection websites and forums and groups and stuff. There's a lot of cool cast iron out there.
Even some of the Dutch ovens have like a little notch around the rim to allow steam to escape and everything.
So. Others have like a little dip in the lip of the actual pot to put your spoon in. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't roll into the meal and all that kind of stuff. You can have a ladle sitting right there. Some even have like the handle. Some big Dutch ovens, they'll have those big D-grip handles with the right angle to actually be able to set your lid into, so you have someone to put the lid while you're outside, not putting it on the ground and getting it full of dirt.
Exactly.
Brilliant designs. Like, people, again, we've had this stuff for 2,500 years. We better have some good ideas in them. It's phenomenal material. So many different options. What is your favorite piece of cast iron? I just got to ask you this.
My favorite piece of cast iron... Let's see. This is a tough question. I love them all the same. They're my children. But obviously, like all parents, we have a favorite. So I would say I like my griddle slash grill one. This is the classic one.
The flat just top stuff.
The rectangular with that little grease catcher along the bottom. I mean, there's so many possibilities. You can use it to cook your bacon and eggs in the morning, to toasts and toast, and do whatever you need. And just even larger meals too.
You catch a trout.
Yeah.
Put it right there.
And they're the perfect size for your Coleman stove, your double burner stove and everything like that. And then, flip over the other side. You got your raised ledges for your grills and everything. So, and it gives you somewhere for all your oil and fat to drip out of and run to. So I really like those because you can just,
they're versatile.
They're flat, easy.
And they're, you can even like, you can use them as almost like a warming space as well on the edge of the fire. If you have a fire pit going, have it set across a couple of rocks, put your, when you're done pouring and percolating the coffee, you can put it on top of that to keep it warm for a while. All that kind of good stuff. It's like a, it's like a, it's like a flat top, just like any big kitchen, industrial kitchen. You have a flat top. There's a lot of uses there. You can use it the same way. It's a portable.
Exactly. And they're smooth too. They don't have those deep pores like the other ones have.
Yeah.
They're the polished, well done ones. And it's just so easy. Just double handles on either side. They're easy. They store away nice and flat. Oh, so you don't have to worry about this big chunky crock pot size thing. So
you can tuck it into a wand again. You can slide it underneath a board in your truck.
You can even incorporate into the design of your lid or something like
that. A bunch of different stuff.
Somewhere to store it away nice and easy, flat. It takes up a quarter inch, half inch of space at most. So I'd say that's my favorite. What's yours?
I think it's my, so I have a 10 inch and I have a 12 inch, or number 10 and number 12 Dutch oven from Lodge. The smaller of the two I got when I was working at the Pro Hardware I worked at in high school.
Yeah.
I've told stories about working at Pro Hardware before. Hi, Pro Hardware. Hope you're still existing. It was a Lodge number 10 or 10 inch, whatever they call it. And I loved the legs. It was, I read like, On Your Own in the Wilderness by Colonel Townsend Whalen and Bradford Andrew, and they talk about Dutch ovens. It was the first time I ever heard the term. And then I was working at Pro Hardware and they had them for sale there. I'm like, oh God.
Yeah.
Staff discount? Really? Okay. And I just went for it and I bought one. And it was a huge learning curve, but it was the first piece of cast iron I owned. So I've got a soft spot for it. But it's such a versatile tool. As we said about before, I was able to make my first bread in the woods in that Dutch oven. I was able to deep fry donuts and deep fry like chicken wings and stuff that we had out of the camp. I was able to make all my stews. I could use it for roasting. I could use it for broiling. My favorite thing I ever figured out was when you actually flip the entire pot over and use the three legs. That's one way that you can set it up to do the griddle.
Yeah.
And I was able to do like, almost treat like a shallow wok with a bunch of leeks and fiddle heads and all this stuff. Do like spring cooking with students right there on that with a little coals underneath it. It's such a great piece. I'm just mad that his bale sucks right now. But it's still my favorite piece. I baby that one. I'm always re-seasoning it. I'm not sure what happened to the seasoning. It has some cracking and rusting happening. So I'm going to be stripping it this week or so.
I feel like it could do with a full makeover.
That thing's been seasoned since 2011.
Yeah.
Like every year it gets like another coating at least.
Yeah.
That thing's, when that one piece of seasoning cracked off on us when we were sitting there, it was like an eighth of an inch thick.
Yeah.
It was as thick as the dragonfly knife that's on my belt. I think it's time to strip the rust off, and we'll talk, or strip the seasoning off. We'll talk about that in a moment.
But
it's my favorite piece just because it's nostalgia for me. It was my first piece, and I've learned so much about cast iron with that one piece. I absolutely love it for that.
That's the thing. I've been shopping around for Dutch ovens for a few years now. Other things keep popping up in the way, but that's been one of the ones that have caught my, that exact design, everything.
They're great.
Get one. That's one of the ones I kind of want. It's a decent size too.
Well, let's think about this. I don't have a griddle. and you have a griddle. I have a Dutch oven. You want a Dutch oven. We can just go camping together all the time.
Yeah.
So we'll have all the
camping. This is how we do it anyway.
We might as well.
What's yours is mine, and mine is yours.
Exactly. We share everything, including this dog. Her butt against me, her head against you.
She's breathing down my butt crack right now. It's slightly awkward.
I love it. All right. So Once you find your piece, whether it's a cast iron skillet or a Dutch oven, what have you, it's used. Let's just start with used. Mm-hmm. What do we got to do?
What do you got to do? Well, it depends what state your cast iron is.
Very true.
Whether it's completely coated in rust, if it's something that you're looking through your grandparents' old barn or something like that.
Caleb's backyard.
And he found this old piece in the backyard. What do I do with it now? Well, if it's rusted up and everything, there's quite a few options. There's some of the modern ones, like people are using coke for a de-ruster.
Yep.
Because of the acids in the coke will break it down and everything. You can do that, or else you can go old fashioned with vinegar, water, baking soda, that kind of stuff. So what I'll typically do is I'll take a 50-50 mix, vinegar, water. I'll let that soak inside. You typically, in a perfect world, if you don't mind spending a lot of money on vinegar and filling the whole thing, some of them you're like, oh yeah, just fill a tub with 50-50 vinegar and water and soak it in there. But I don't want to use a gallon of vinegar just to redo it, unless I've got like 10 pieces I want to do.
Exactly.
Sort of thing.
Make it worth your money then.
So what I'll normally do is I'm worried about the inside of the pan or pot the most. Mm-hmm. So I'll just leave like a half an inch to an inch of the solution in there. I'll leave it overnight, 8 hours. You do in the morning, do it after dinner sort of thing. And I'll do that just so it starts eating away at that as quick as possible.
Right.
So, or else sometimes I'll just go and I'll splash a little bit of time, work with a scour pad with some steel wool, and you just start scraping it away.
Totally.
Or else then you can take your baking soda, add a little water. You want to get to like a paste consistency. Mm-hmm. You don't want it too wet.
Yeah.
Anything like that. It's easier to move around when it's just in like a toothpaste consistency.
Right. And it's going to work like a toothpaste. It's going to scrub. It's going
to
scour.
It's going to scrub. It's going to scour. It's going to give you some grit to work with. So I kind of just muscle my way through it.
Yeah.
And do that. I work on the inside first. I'll take as much time as I need on the inside, the area that's going to be touching my food the most. And it's typically what's going to be the most rusted out. If it's been sitting out in a backyard, in a barn, in a shed, that is where it's going to collect water unless it's flipped upside down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I find the thickest rust is normally on the inside of the pan.
Right.
So I just scrub there, get around the bottom, just nice circular motions, mix it up a bit to make sure each piece of the steel wool is hitting that steel and scraping it off. And then once in a while, I'll just dump what's in there because it just turns to a murky chocolate milk colored solution or whatever.
It's not appetizing.
And you can no longer see what you're scrubbing.
You're looking at it going, I'm actually going to cook in this thing?
Yeah.
This doesn't look like it's going to work.
And then I just sit there and I scrub away on the walls, around the rim.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually where I get to a point where I like it, I'll wipe it, dry it a little bit, just so it's always going to form a nice little surface rust after you've washed it, cleaned it, it's been exposed to water.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to have a light film, but don't worry about that for now.
Mm-hmm.
And then I flip it over, get it, everything. You're scraping the underside. Oh, look, a logo appears. I didn't know this was a lodge. It was all just caked with rust, and it was just a flat plan before, and all of a sudden you've exposed the logo that's been stamped in the bottom.
Bam, you're now an archaeologist.
So yeah, I'll do that for a while, jumping back and forth between the baking soda water paste and the vinegar water solution. And I'll just do that until I don't see any large deposits. I don't see any. I make sure there's no pits that I miss. Some of them are harder to catch. Some of it will just be on the surface and some will be in those pores.
Mm-hmm.
So just go nice and scrape with it with a nice heavy duty steel. You don't want the fine steel wool.
No, it's all just going to
fall
stuff.
Apart. You want the coarse scouring pad. So that's what I use the most. And then once that is done and I've got all the rust aside from possible surface rust and I've wiped it clean, I'll run it through soapy water. I'll wash it like I do any other dish and give it a nice scrubbing. That'll help get some of the residue. It'll get the acids from the vinegars and everything neutralize off that. Of there and neutralize, as well as the baking soda does help with that a bit too. So I'll just do that. I'll get that a nice scrub, and you'll see the stuff that was hidden down inside while you were scraping it. It'll get murky water again, mm-hmm. and I'll do that for a little bit. And then once I take that out, I'll give it a nice rinse all over, make sure I didn't miss anywhere with the soap. And then I'll give that a thorough drying with a paper towel normally, because then you can see too what's coming off there. Mm-hmm. Dry, dry, dry. Meanwhile, I'm heating up the oven to 450, 500 degrees, even 550, as you were saying. You like to go really scorched earth.
Yeah, I want to kill everything.
Yeah, I'll go 500. Lowest I'd go is 450, sort of thing.
With an electric oven, I always recommend go as high as you can with propane up, because let's be honest, electric ovens are not coming to 550. They're like, it's probably closer to 525, 530.
Yeah, every oven's different. Yeah. Like you get a new oven and it's completely thrown you for a loop compared to what your own last oven used to bake like.
Yeah.
I've even had stuff where I have like a thermometer that goes from the outside of the oven into the inside of my own one alone doing certain projects, and it'll have a completely different reading on the digital readout.
Trust that number
compared to what your oven is telling you. So I noticed the newer oven I have at home tends to be on 15 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than the typical.
Oh, interesting. Usually I find them cooler there.
So
interesting.
The LG likes to go scorched earth as well.
I like LG then. Luckily, we got a propane oven and stove in the new house. But anyways, I like high heat for the seasoning process. Mm-hmm. It's the higher the heat. Before we go too far into the seasoning process, the simplest thing to remember, no matter what we tell you here, if your cast iron is brown, get it hotter.
Yeah,
that's the main thing you need to know for seasoning. If the cast iron is still brown, not black, get it hotter.
Yeah.
Okay. It doesn't matter how long you leave it in there. If it's brown, it's not hot enough.
You don't want it to be sticky to the touch.
No.
Afterwards, once it's cooled and dried and everything, you don't want it to stick to your fingers feeling as glossy kind of.
It should feel like
slightly
glass.
Sticky. It should feel smooth.
Yeah.
It should feel like metal pretty much.
Yeah. Before we dive too far into the seasoning process, we should mention a couple other methods you can do to strip. Mm-hmm. To strip your cast iron specifically, folks. Don't take this too far. First off is lye.
Yeah.
Lye is a very popular one because not only does it remove rust, it removes the old seasoning. So you can do that with vinegar as well. You just have to leave it long. The longer you can wait. When I use vinegar, I'll do like a Rubbermaid, and I don't go 50-50. I'll do like 1 or 2 liters of vinegar, and I just fill the tub as deep as I need with water. I just fill it up, and I'll leave it for like 2 or 3 days. And when you come back, the cast iron is just gray. It's slat gray, it's slate gray, drab gray color. And everything else is just this frothy, foamy crud that has gotten out of the way. See, lye can do that in a matter of hours. And it's cheaper than vinegar.
Just make sure you have your extra safety equipment.
And that's what I was going to get into. You have to. And that's the same thing even with like vinegars and stuff. They can dry your skin out. Any chemical, treat it like chemistry class. You have to treat it like chemistry class. Safety glasses, gloves, heavy rubber gloves or whatever is recommended. KI or whatever it is for lye. You don't need a lot of it. You're just trying to make an extreme alkali-based solution in the water. Start with a distilled water or tap water that, and add a little bit more lye if you need to. Check with pH strips, all that kind of stuff. There's a bunch of instructions online that you can find all over the place for stripping cast iron with lye. It happens fast. Like Ryan was saying with his method, you know, wait 8-9 hours, wait overnight.
Yeah.
Me with my diluted vinegar, it's like 2 or 3 days. This is... make your lunch. Make your lunch. Clean up. By the time you're done putting away all the dishes, you can probably take it out of the pot, out of the bucket. It's very, very fast. It's very, very aggressive. You got to really well wash it afterwards and neutralize that alkali, or else you're going to burn your skin even after a light rinsing. Some people will even spray it with vinegar afterwards to try and neutralize the lye. Mm-hmm. But it works fast. Another method that is used by some people is electrolysis baths.
Yeah.
just like the lie, safety. You were putting electricity into liquid, not just electricity and water, but electricity and electrolyte water.
Yeah.
Stuff that makes it conduct much better. Mm-hmm. This is not the kind of stuff you want to fool around with. Either get a professional electrolysis bath built for you, find someone who's an electrician who can build one for you. Please don't be that guy that strips some wires out of an old speaker and grabs his dad's car battery.
Yeah.
Please be safe with this stuff. There's a reason I have not used an electrolysis bath myself. I've been shocked twice in my entire life, and I'm scared to get shocked a third time because the third time is the charm. I don't want it. You will not see an electrolysis bath at my house unless it's built by a professional, like electrical engineer kind of person. Mm-hmm. I don't play with electricity. I don't want to be struck by lightning again. Figuratively speaking, I've never been struck by lightning. But anyways, before that rumor starts up, end up being like that guy with the skunk hair from the Great Outdoors movie.
This explains a lot.
Anyways, it does actually. Okay. So you have alkali or lye baths. You have electrolysis baths. The problem with the electrolysis bath is it doesn't always get all the seasoning, but it will get all the rust.
Yeah.
It is one of the most efficient ways. Like any pour that has iron oxide in it does not have iron oxide anymore. Mm-hmm. It is very, very efficient. So that in mind, talking about stripping, there's other methods as well. The simplest way, if you don't have a lot of material, you don't have a lot of supplies, you're kind of broke, but you live in a kind of rural area, burn it. You can burn off the seasoning and you can burn off all that iron oxide by getting it into a hot enough campfire. If you just bury it in a bunch of wood, light the fire up. And this is a very crude version of the oven cleaning method. Mm-hmm. I've never had an oven that does oven cleaning, the self-cleaning oven stuff. Some people recommend putting it inside a self-cleaning oven and putting on cleaning mode. And the idea behind that is it incinerates everything. Everything gets stripped because of the extreme heat inside the oven at the time. There's varying opinions.
Yeah.
Some people love it. Some people hate it. Some people say it works for some stuff and not others.
Some people say it's unsafe.
Yeah.
Run your oven at that high heat sort of thing. I guess It depends how dirty your oven is.
Yeah.
With the chance of all the debris at the bottom catching fire sort of thing. So.
And I've had an oven fire. That was a scary day when that happened. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what to do other than yank the oven out of the wall and unplug it.
Yeah.
It was a scary, scary moment. The entire element just caught on fire.
Yeah.
From a little bit of grease that fell out of something, I think. Mm-hmm. But anyways, don't play around with that stuff too much. If your oven has a self-cleaning mode, it's recommended by most people who are appliance workers to use that on a frequent basis to remove the risk. Mm-hmm. It's just like with a wood stove and your chimney with creosote. Burn it clean, burn it hot occasionally to get rid of any buildup, knock the stuff loose, frequently maintain. So if you do use a self-cleaning mode for your oven, for your cast iron, it will be safe then. I've heard a lot of varying opinions. I have nothing to tell you other than the fact that it's the same thing as putting it in an extremely hot fire. The only difference is when it comes out of your oven, it's not going to be covered in ash. You got to then wash your cast iron if you do the fire method. It will strip cast iron seasoning. It will strip the rust. It'll strip everything. It's the genuine scorched earth method for stripping seasoning, but it will be dirty. You're going to have to scrub it out really well, get rid of all the ash that's stuck on it, all that kind of stuff.
Well, even just for reference, with the mode I talked about was it took about maybe 8-9 hours with breaks in between, given my forearms a break and everything like that. It took about that much time total, just scrubbing. I woke up, start scrubbing, whatever. And then once I'm satisfied with that one, go get it ready. I put it to the side so I could do the seasoning of more than one pan at once, so I wasn't just wasting the electricity heat, and heat. I'm just doing one little tiny pan at a time.
Putting a one egg skillet in one set at a time.
So it's going to take some time if you go that method.
Yeah.
It's a lot more cost friendly, I guess. And as well as you're not working with harmful chemicals or anything like that other than vinegar.
Yeah.
So it's going to take you some time, but it's worth it at the end of the day.
And if it seems to not be working, give it time.
Yeah.
Leave it in there longer. Leave it in the soak longer.
What's even at the end when there was still some really troublesome parts where the rust was really thick, I took paper towel, soaked it a little bit of vinegar, and then just mummified it.
Paper mache.
And then just let that rest for another hour while I go and sit and watch some hockey or something.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just do that at the end. Just if you're not completely satisfied and you still got a few spots of deeper rust, then just leave that and you come back. Your paper towel is turning reddish brown. You take that off, give it another little quick scrape with the steel wool, and it should be good. Maybe give it another clean and soapy water, dry it again.
Totally.
And then get ready for seasoning.
Yeah, and that's what we're on to next is the seasoning process. So for those who are like, okay, do I put salt and pepper on it? Is this paprika? Seasoning is the term that's used for the coating that is put onto your cast iron. Seasoning is a polymerized oil that has, under extreme heat, turned into a food-grade plastic. That's what it is. It's the same thing as what they do to make plastic bottles out of petroleum oil. You take the oil, you get to a certain heat, and it turns into a polymer. So that's what it is at the end of the day.
It's even like when you take a stainless steel frying pan or pot, and you've cooked in something in there, and it burns to the bottom of it, and you get those big black blotches on there. That's pretty much seasoning.
Yeah, right, that's crude impromptu seasoning pretty much. And the goal with the seasoning is A, protect your cast iron from rust. That's if you got good seasoning, it won't rust from just ambient air moisture. Mm-hmm. It would have to be soaked in something for a while.
Yeah.
Secondly, to make as much of a nonstick coating as possible. Those are the two main reasons. There's a lot of other reasons people will give you about why seasoning is important, but those are the two main ones. Protect it from the elements.
It's like varnishing wood.
Yeah. And it's a lot of things.
Protects it from moisture and everything like that.
And there's a lot of, like we were talking about this earlier, there's a lot of similarities between oiling our wooden utensils and tools and seasoning cast iron. Mm-hmm. The first thing that's very similar is something that you love to bring up, thickness of your coatings.
Yeah.
What's that all about?
So just like if you're familiar with carving wood and then staining and varnishing, sealing your wood, start low and work up in stages. You're not going to finish it all in one swoop. Just light layers at a time. Let that soak in, let it do its thing, let it harden on there before you get to your next step. Like, just as a basis for my cast iron, I'll season it a series of three times, 500 for an hour each time, sort of thing. So just little layers at a time, or else you'll run into the problem like Caleb spoke of, where you have a big glob of brown oil that's sticky to the touch. And then
it fills the corners between the bottom and the side, and you're like, oh, I remember that there was more space in there.
And then you go to cook some chicken and sear a chicken breast or something on there,
black sludge,
and it just sticks to the bottom of it.
Yeah.
And your best spatula can't even scrape it off of there. You've added way too much seasoning
at once. It. Yeah. It's kind of like with linseed oil on an axe handle. You don't want to just coat it and like paint it in it. You want to. The best way I've ever heard it was John Townsend from James Townsend and Sons YouTube channel. You want to put all the oil you can on that cast iron and then do your damnedest to remove all of it.
Yeah.
You want the thinnest film of oil on that. You just want to fill all the pores and a little bit of very thin, like less than a micromillimeter.
Wipe it on, then wipe it off. Wax on, wax off.
Exactly. Oh God. When's Cobra Kai coming back? So you're going to put a very thin coat on, and then you're going to put it in your oven, or you're going to put it. My recommendation is if you have it, barbecue with a thermometer, so you know exactly what temperature it is inside with a proper thermometer, not just the barbecue thermometer, your thermometer. Between, I like to go minimum 500 and up. And going back to that thing that we said earlier, if it's brown, get it hotter. Mm-hmm. So you're going to do that once, and then you said you do that three times.
Yeah, I'll do that three times just so I'm guaranteed to get a good, even, consistent layer.
And how long do you have it in the oven for?
For an hour at least.
About an hour? Okay.
Sometimes, like you were talking about earlier, 45 minutes, I'll check on it, make sure. Meanwhile, this is all happening. It's going to get pretty smoky.
Yeah.
So if you have a hood fan.
Yeah.
If you have windows to open that up, or else you're going to smoke yourself out.
Yep.
Although it's going to smell like fried chicken while you're doing it. So if you're using a nice vegetable oil, then...
There you go. That's why I recommend the barbecue. It's outside. People expect it to have a smell.
It's ventilated.
Yeah.
It's good to go.
and this comes to the next part. What do we season with? Historically, it was pork lard.
Yeah.
That was the number one use of pork lard outside of cooking, was to use it to season cast iron. There's a few reasons we don't do it now. There's a lot of explanations why we don't use it now. Some people still use it because why not? The first issue is it's a very low flashpoint oil.
Yeah.
So when you try to get it up to the 500 to polymerize, it's already burning before it gets there. Mm-hmm. And that can lead to carcinogenic plastics, which means that if there's any seasoning that flakes off in your food, it's more likely to be cancer-causing than if it was plant-based, like flaxseed oil or grapeseed oil or whatnot. The other reason that people argue against it now is because, allegedly, and I sound like Squirrely Dan saying that, this is what I've heard through the grapevine from many people in hushed circles around fires at the camps and stuff. Allegedly, because of the diet that we've given pigs in the last 150 years, their fat has changed in how it forms so that it doesn't polymerize as well as it used to. And you got to get it even hotter.
Okay.
Like 625, 650. The theory is from the corn-fed millet diets that are getting now compared to their old wild diets and their old domestic diets from the old days with a bunch of different silage and stuff coming to them. The theory is that's why pork chops don't burn as easily now. The pork chop people didn't like that their pork chops would burn easily on the barbecue because pork meat is very light.
Yeah.
That's why it's called the other white meat and all that kind of stuff. Or no, wait, that's babies. The other white meat. Sorry, that was an Austin Powers reference before anybody gets offended by my joke. The idea is the fat has to get to a higher temperature now, which completely contradicts the other reason people don't recommend it. It has a lower smoking point.
Yeah.
So I believe the first one. I don't believe the second one. It sounds like an old wives' tale or an urban legend that we've somehow genetically engineered animals to not burn. Mm-hmm. If that was the case, we would be invincible by now.
Yeah.
But yeah, the main reason that people don't recommend lard from pork or other animal fats in general is they have a very low smoke point, which means they burn easily before you get to the polymerizing stage at 500, 550, yada, yada, yada. What most people use nowadays is either grapeseed oil, flaxseed oil. Some people use walnut oil. I don't recommend it usually because, again, it's a low flash point or low smoke point oil. Some people use canola.
Yeah.
And vegetable oils and peanut oils.
I've used vegetable oils on mine because I got the big old
jug
of it anyway. So
might as well use it.
Find flaxseed oil tends to be a little more on the expensive side.
It is.
You get it from a health food store that's $20 for 500 milliliters.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky.
Oh, man. I think the last bottle I bought was like $37 for like 400 milliliters.
Yeah.
Like, this is insulting.
That's the thing. I haven't even used it, so that's why I don't even know the price. That is for some of my health stuff, but...
Yep. You can use one of my favorites is sunflower seed oil. I like it. And it works just as good as canola. It works just as good as the others. There's a lot of like give and take on opinions. Again, this is just like all the other things we were warning you about with cast iron. There's a lot of mystique around cast iron, and everybody has their own like rules that must be followed. Don't worry about it. Whatever oil you have, check it out. Google to make sure it doesn't become Google like flat out. Can I season cast iron with blank? Mm-hmm. And if you can, use it. Don't worry about whether it's the best of the best. Because again, it's just an oil you're turning into a polymer. That's all that matters.
Well, the reason why people prefer stuff like flaxseed is because of the smoke point.
Yeah.
It takes a lot longer to burn off sort of thing.
Yeah. So. And that's why I use it. I love it because my entire kitchen, except for like four or five pans, is cast iron.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure my cast iron is the best ability it is. Mm-hmm. But if I run out of flaxseed oil, it's not like I'm going to go running to the closest health food store to grab some. I'm going to go to the gas station, grab a bottle of sunflower seed oil, and season my cast iron.
Yeah, my typical basic vegetable oil worked perfect for it.
And it works.
You do it three layers, whatever. Who cares? It's good to go.
Yeah. Again, going back to that original Lodge Dutch oven I got, at least two of those layers of seasoning that I got to strip off of it are Bear Grease.
Okay.
I know, because years back I had this little bottle of Bear Grease I had nothing else to season with, and it had to get some seasoning on it. And it worked great. It made one of the glassiest, hardest surfaces I ever had on cast iron to date.
Yeah.
To this day, I have not seen as smooth of a cast iron in my collection as what came out of that Bear Grease. Mm-hmm. So I've got that little bottle of raccoon oil. So when I strip this, I'm thinking of testing out the raccoon oil on it and see how that does. Raccoon oil, for those of you wondering, fat from a raccoon. Rendered filtered fat from a raccoon. It's the same as bear grease and consistency and everything else. But yeah, I know some people that literally just wipe a piece of beef tallow on the inside, wipe it down, get it to smoke, and that's like their pre-seasoning or their mid-seasons. Mm-hmm. So there's some people that will season in between meals. There's people that will season every time they wash, all that kind of stuff. And those are what we call like mid-seasonings. You're not doing a full seasoning session. All you're doing is putting on a little thin, like extremely thin coating of oil, heat up your cast iron until it smokes. Turn off the heat or take it off the heat and let it just cool slowly. Other people let it smoke till it stops smoking. I don't recommend that.
It's cleaning without washing it.
Exactly.
Sort of thing. So you're just baking on everything, getting that taste into there that people love about cast iron. So,
and the last thing to say on this part, like the seasoning process, it's a polymer. It's a food grade plastic. You're fine washing it in your sink. You're fine washing it with Dawn dish soap or Sunlight detergent or whatever it is you use to wash your dishes, as long as it's not lye based. Don't, if you're going old timey and you're making your own soaps, maybe not use that.
And just also don't treat the seasoning as if it's dirt. And I've seen people like, it's not coming off, I can't get this clean. And I think that's where people run into those problems too, where they're removing the seasoning just for sake, and that's when the grandmas come in and faint or slap you upside the head for ruining their cast iron pan. So just be wary of that sort of thing.
My favorite thing is to clean my cast iron. We only got a couple more points to make before we go into the next part of cast iron. Lodge makes these stove grade nylon scrapers.
Yeah,
nylon's perfect because it's not going to be too aggressive on your seasoning, but it's going to get everything that's in there off the surface.
Yeah.
So if you did burn a piece of like bread in there and it's stuck on, you can scrape it off with one of those. A tip on cleaning: if it's hot, it's easier to clean it. The pores are open.
Yeah.
Add a little bit of water. That steam. The best thing I've ever done is I do a half and half of apple cider vinegar and just regular sink water, like dish, tap water.
Yeah.
Get it not scorching hot, just warm, and spray it until you see the mist come up. Not necessarily a bunch of steam jets. You don't want to touch that, then you're going to burn yourself. And as it's kind of misting and starting to steam, scrub. Just scrub. You can use coarse kosher salt with a potato as a scrubber. You can use the spatula scrapers. You can use really whatever scouring tools you usually use for your dishes, as long as it's not, you know, hardcore stainless steel wires. But yeah, that's the easiest way. And if you do it properly, your seasoning will last forever. Okay, so we've begun seasoning. The oven's warm. What do we do now, Ryan?
So yeah, like I was talking about with the cleaning process, you have that dried after cleaning skillet or whatever you've got. So then you just get your oil of choice. You'll wipe it over just paper towel, microfiber towel, whatever you've got kind of thing. Easy enough. Give a nice thin layer, wipe it on, like we said, wax on, wax off, wipe it on, handle and everything. I do it all just since you're trying to seal it all anyway.
Whole enchilada.
So get that nice and good to go. Some people, they'll put a cookie tray, baking sheet on a lower rack in their oven.
Oh, to catch like drippings
and stuff? To catch the drippings and stuff, because when you do it, you want to flip your pan upside down. You don't want it the way you'd put it in while you're cooking something. You want any excess to drip down and off the pan, because you don't want it collecting and getting that big gooey brown glob like we were talking about. So you get it. You've got your oven at 500, 550. Put it upside down above that cookie tray to catch everything. And then you just let it sit. Go for an hour. The next steps where I feel like that's when you can get away with doing it for 45 minutes or something like that, because you've already got a preheated pan. One thing you want to make sure of when you take it out of the oven, make sure you have all your oven mitts. Get something that's high heat, because especially if it's still got a little oil on it, if it's still sticky and runny a bit, just leave it in a little longer. if it still looks shiny like it was when you put it in, sort of thing, and it hasn't completely polymerized.
Yep.
So just make sure you do it well. I got a little tiny burn on my thumb just glancing against it one of the times when I was wiping it, but you can roll up a dish towel. You can get your nice big silicone oven mitt like they have these days. And then I'll just take it out by the handle. And again, hit it with the oil right away. And you can see it smoking, which is good because it's already starting the season there on your stovetop, sort of thing. So immediately I'll do another quick run, wipe it down nice and clean, stick it right back in there, and then let it go for another 45 minutes to an hour. And then just keep on repeating that. And hopefully by now you don't, the first time you rub oil on, you might get some of that surface rust off of there, but just oiling it there and wiping it down will remove that anyway. So you don't need to worry too much about that. And then subsequently, just as the more you season, the first time you use it, you might get a little bit of a metallic taste to it. It's not too bad. We all need iron to live anyway. You don't want to be anemic.
So. That's actually what a lot of people recommend for people who are anemic is cook pasta sauces and chilies in cast iron pots.
Yeah.
Because it leaches iron.
Exactly.
So it's a great option.
Essential minerals right there.
Yeah.
In your food.
There you go.
So yeah, do that. You can do it once, you can do it twice, you can do it three times, you can do it six times if you wanted to be overzealous. But yeah, I find three is a good Goldilocks zone for that sort of thing. It's it's enough that you've got your layers in there. You know that you've got a decent, especially if you're doing nice thin layers, then you're good to go.
Totally. We so first and foremost, your first coating won't look great.
Yeah.
Usually, like sometimes it does come out looking perfect, but it's usually because it's a lot of that oil had to get into pores. It had to get into all those little nooks and crannies. It's trying to make the surface begin. Don't be, you know, disgruntled. Don't be dissuaded. It's going to work. Just
might keep even look a little blotchy at first.
Just keep painting them down. The most beautiful cast iron pans I've ever seen in my life are at my father's hunt camp, and they stay there year round in the cabin, and they're like obsidian. But if you look at them closely enough, you can see that they're splotchy from layer after layer being put on.
Exactly.
But because the owner of the hunt camp really takes care of that cast iron, he gets good seasonings on it, they're beautiful from anyone's eyes. Like, I watched that guy flip eggs with no spatula. He's flipping pancakes, no spatula.
Yeah.
Every time. The guy's a whiz with his cast iron. If you just take your time, be patient with it, coat thinly, wipe off as much as you can, take it to the heat, like Ryan was telling you, bring it out, re-oil, put it right back in, heat it back up, let it go for the 45 to an hour, like Ryan said, bring it back out, repeat. And it may not even look perfect on the third coating, but when you go to eat the next time, do that mid-coat, that mid-seasoning where you wipe it all down, put a little bit of oil, wipe it off, let it smoke, and you'll see it build up. It's in your building. Like everything else me and Ryan like about bushcraft, you're building character in your gear. It's not going to look like a monoculture piece of cast iron that's like the same color. It's not painted. It's not painted. That's the beauty. It's it's natural. Part there will be on the outside, on the bottom of your pan, just because you're outside cooking all the time, there'll be thin films of rust around the logo.
Yeah.
That just happen. And you wipe a little bit of oil the next chance you get on them. No big deal. And as it goes, this cast iron just builds a personality, and you have a relationship with it. It's a living part of your kit, in a sense.
Each blotch tells a story.
Oh yeah, that's where I burned my cast iron. I burned my cornbread. That's where I burned. This is when I had to re-season it because I got a bunch of vinegar on there from trying to make it maple vinegar with Caleb in the kitchen. All those crazy things that happen. It's a beautiful piece of equipment. There's a lot of tips and tricks we can dive into.
Well, even one more thing I would add before, after your last round of seasoning, turn off your oven and just leave it in there. Let it cool down with the oven itself.
I agree.
And then the next morning when you wake up and it's had 8 to 10 hours to cool down, you've got a nice brand new pan ready to go out of the oven, ready to cook with our tips and tricks.
It's a beautiful thing to have. I can't wait. I can't wait to see your the cast iron you're working on. in person soon.
I've got a couple in the backseat of the car.
Oh, we're using them tomorrow. 100% we're using those tomorrow. So a couple of tips that I recommend and that Ryan recommend. We're going to just kind of bounce off. Whenever I have an idea, I'll say it. When Ryan has an idea, he'll say it. The first one I want to get at is, it is okay to use steel utensils with well-seasoned cast iron. If it's not great seasoning, you will probably chip it. The better option, and since we're into bushcraft, carve yourself some wooden spatulas and utensils.
Yeah.
Wood will not damage the seasoning. It's okay to use steel. I use steel in my skillets. I have a nice steel spatula that I love to use. And that's because I trust my seasoning. I really trust my seasoning. I've been using cast iron for 18 plus years. I know what I'm doing with it. I trust it. But there's no harm in just making a nice apple wood spatula with a couple of spoons. Get yourself a bamboo set of tongs or something like that, or make your own tongs. And A, you're building up your bushcraft skills. B, you know you're not going to damage your seasoning. And C, it kind of just adds to the ambiance. You're out there in the woods using your own utensils to cook and cast iron that you refurbished yourself. So that's my first tip. Wood is always great. If you trust your seasoning, steel is okay. Don't listen to the naysayers. Just know that you have to use good seasoning and do a well done job on it. Follow Ryan's tips on that. Tip that you got for that? For cast iron?
Oh, one of them that pops in my head right away would be acidic foods. It's a little bit of acidity is not going to necessarily kill it and de-season your pot, but don't be squeezing too many fresh lemons and limes into your pot sort of thing. Just be careful.
Yep.
I tend to carry, I like to bring a lot of stainless steel too, because I like to cook that over the fire and everything. So sauces and things like we were talking about earlier, sautéing could be a little easier when you're really worried about the right heat in it. So maybe save your tomato sauce with whatever else in a separate pan or something.
Or a pot or something like that.
Yeah.
On that note, though, I think especially for at home, I do a lot of pasta sauce and chili in my cast iron.
Yeah.
The trick that you really got to remember is don't leave it in the cast iron.
Exactly. That's what I mean. Within moderation.
Get it out of there. Rinse it out well. And then that's the time where you want to give it a good scrub or wipe down with a paper towel and put a little bit of oil into it. Do a post-seasoning or a mid-seasoning session. Don't leave it in there. It's okay to cook in there. It's not good to leave it in there. I know everybody wants to just leave the pasta sauce on the stovetop. Don't.
You get people on a canoe trip that their eyes are bigger than their stomach on that day, and they can't finish it. So you end up with half the pot still full of chili.
Yeah.
That you hate to throw away.
Yeah, that's when you want to have another container to put it into.
Yeah.
Or like those special food bags that can be sealed shut that are you can put a sauce in.
Yeah.
Things like that. Great idea to bring along with you. Another tip that I want to recommend, especially for those of you that are getting into Dutch ovens, you can put coals if the lid is the right type. The two Dutch ovens I use in the house have domed lids. So they don't hold the coals very well, but the two we take camping have lips on them that are meant to hold coals. The trick to being able to bake well, whether you're making bread or a cake, muffins, cornbread, sourdough, tarts, whatever it may be, whatever your trick. Again, a Dutch oven is an oven. You can do any baking you want to do in it, or you can do any roasting you want in it. The two tips to go with that to help you have more success. A, twice the coals on the top than you have on the bottom. Heat rises. So if I have, let's keep it even, 10 lumps of coal, charcoal under my oven, I'm going to have 20 pieces on top because I got to get more heat to go downward than I do for it to go upward. Okay, that's just simple thermodynamics and physics. Heat rises, therefore it'll be easier to heat the bottom of the oven with 10 pieces of charcoal than it would to do the same with the same amount on top. So I have to double the amount. The second tip, because we're in the outdoors and there's these amazing variables called wind, one half of your Dutch oven is always going to be cooler than the other half. So what is recommended is you turn your Dutch oven every 15 minutes, 1/4 turn. So you turn it 90 degrees clockwise, but turn your lid back counterclockwise, one quarter turn, so you're still getting the same even heat. That way you can evenly cook what's inside. If it's a loaf of bread or you're doing a cake or something, you'd need to make sure it's evenly heated with wind and all those variables. You have to do this quarter turn method. Every 15 to 20 minutes, turn it one quarter, 90 degree turn, and then turn the lid back so that you have even heat. The other option is build a wind wall. Mm-hmm. Remove the whole variable altogether. That's a little bit harder unless you got a bunch of rocks around. My favorite is to stack. If you have it in the backyard or you have it at a base camp or a hunt camp, you can build an L bracket wall, like two walls together of cinder block. Easiest wind wall in the world. You have a corner just to nudge your Dutch oven into and just put the coals in. It's perfect, easy answer. So you have to think about you have to think about the actual heat source. Double the amount of heat on top than you have on the bottom. And you have to think about wind and other variables that are cooling parts and about even cooking. Do not be afraid to open the lid once in a while and take a look. Just don't make it a frequent thing because you don't want to lose all that heat you've been working hard to get in there. Any other tips you've got, Ry?
One is, although you've already built up an amazing seasoning on it, you'll still want to grease the pan or pot. If you were searing or anything, you'll still want some vegetable oil, some butter, some lard, whatever oil or grease of choice is, then still give it that. It's not going to be like a Teflon pan where you can necessarily get away with just searing straight on there and then give a little jiggle and it's free. Mm-hmm. So just to make sure you don't have any sticking to the bottom of the pan problems, make sure you still oil. And then there was that one tip you were mentioning. Your cook friend says if you've seasoned with vegetable-based oils, then cook with
animal-based.
And vice versa.
So if I season these pots with bear grease or raccoon fat, I'm going to want to use things like canola oil or olive oil or walnut oil or what have you for the cooking. And the idea there, I haven't seen the research to support it, but he's a very good chef with a lot of respect in his industry. Maybe
it's flavor profile, something possible.
What he says, it's because it makes it extremely slippery, though.
Okay.
Because they're two different kinds of oils. Yeah. They can't mix.
Okay.
So they're not going to, if you have your seasoning, because even when you fully polymerize, it's still an oil.
Yeah.
So if you have, let's say, flaxseed oil and you put some olive oil in there, that might make it a little sludgier.
Okay.
Whereas what he believes from his experience, from what he said he had researched, if you use something like butter or ghee, like a clarified butter, or beef tallow is his favorite. It's one of my favorites too for cooking. It's like oil and water. They will not bond. Therefore, your egg will slip off very easily. You will be able to flip that pancake, that kind of concept, which makes sense when you think about it. But I haven't seen a lot of research to support it.
Okay.
So it's his belief,
anecdotal. Yeah.
Yeah. Which a lot of cast iron knowledge is.
Yeah.
It's not like someone did a PhD in this stuff.
If it works, you're not going to peer review.
Exactly. Exactly. So yeah, there's always add an oil. And it doesn't have to be like, you don't have to deep fry. A little bit of butter or a little bit of canola oil or a little bit of this or a little bit of that. A lot of people complain about Pam spray. We found one that's a butter-based one once.
Okay.
And there's other ones you can get that are like avocado-based, ones that are olive oil-based.
Just canola ones.
Yeah, canola ones. Days, yeah. A quick spray, just a quick film. That's all you really need to make sure your pancake doesn't burn to the bottom of your pan. It doesn't need to be deep-fried. You don't have to boil it in oil, but add some oil, please, just to save yourself some grief. The other tip that I would throw in just to make sure is just to just do your upkeep. Just keep up on it. Keep an eye on it. Like I was saying earlier, it's like a living member of your kit. You can't just ignore your buddy when you're on the trip. If Ryan is feeling down and he's looking kind of down, I shouldn't just ignore that. I should check in with him, make sure he's doing all right. If my cast iron looks a little messed up, I should check on it, clean it up. There's nothing saying you can't bring a little bottle of cooking oil with you that you can use to season. There's nothing saying you can't bring a little walloper or a scour pad to scrub off some rust. Bring a little maintenance kit. We're bringing maintenance kits for everything else we take out in the woods with us. We might as well bring a little thing in your cook kit.
Even 5 minutes of consistent love here and there is a lot easier than 3 hours of scrubbing down the roads.
So. Just maintain your stuff. Take care of it. TLC. I can't think of too many else that I would throw up. The only other tip I have is practice with it. play with it, use it in the kitchen and in the woods. Get to know your piece of cast iron so you know what it likes, what it doesn't like, where the sweet spot is for your nice little flips for your eggs and everything, all that kind of stuff. And just experiment with cooking.
One last thing I would add is to preheat it if you're doing something like baking.
Yep, totally.
Get it ready to go. Even if you're frying to get that pan hot before you put your oils and stuff in it, before you throw your bacon down into it. But especially with stuff like bread, it's going to be a lot easier to form that crust on the bottom and having it bake right away rather than having that slow warm. Because we talked about how it takes a little longer for cast iron to heat up since it's so thick and dense.
Yeah.
So if you get it heated, ready to go right away, you're a lot easier chance of you getting that nice crusty bottom of your bread. Your cornbread will come right out. There's sometimes where I put it accidentally when I started off testing out cornbreads and skillets and everything. I just put it into the cold greased pan, put it in the oven,
the dough absorbs the grease,
and sometimes it'll cook all the outside but it won't cook the inside, sort of thing. But just make sure you do that, and then it'll just pop right out when you turn it upside down. So
for those who are like, is this really for me? It may not be, but like, you can make flat out the best sourdough in the world comes from either a cob oven, which means you have to build an entire oven, or it comes from cast iron.
That's the thing. People always wanted to know how to bake on a camping trip. You've got reflector ovens and everything, but the tried, tested, true method is Dutch ovens.
And there is book after book after book and recipe after recipe all over the place.
I've got a book on Dutch oven cooking at home and everything. So
Lodge will send you cooking.
We'll have them too. So yeah. There's a lot of resources out there. Lots of videos on YouTube about it. So
many options. There's so many places to get... Cabela's has their own brands of cast iron. Lagostina, IKEA. One of the cast iron pans that you took home with you to work on is an IKEA frying pan.
Well, one was a Lodge, one was Lagostina, and then there was that 8-inch Taiwan one.
Oh, okay. That one was an IKEA.
So none said IKEA. There was, I think it might have been the Lodge one because that was filled with rust on the logo in the bottom. As I scraped, I was like, oh, it's a Lodge. Oh, the handle. Oh, there's the logo. Now it's here. Okay, there Lodge.
As an aside, there's a fourth frying pan out there, but because it was hung up back near the garden, it's been out there since the first year of the pandemic, and it's still not rusty.
Really?
It's got a little bit of like you got the surface coatings, but there's nothing. Like, you could just give it a quick scrub and cook right then and there.
Yeah.
Because it was hung up, and it's one of my oldest pieces I keep seasoned, and I just keep leaving it out there to cook with when I'm out there. I don't bring it inside.
Yeah.
Like, that's if you do a good job with your seasoning and you don't just leave it on the ground where it can collect water and stuff.
Well, that was the problem with the other three. they were sitting in a Rubbermaid container filled with water and just orange.
Yeah. Yeah. When you pulled them out, I went, oh. Because the kicker was we had just finished putting up that tarp shelter back in the summer to store all that stuff out of the rain.
Yeah.
And then midwinter, the storms came in, ripped the tarp off, and covered it in snow and ice, and we couldn't get it recovered.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's happened. But you've saved them. You're their hero. You're my hero in that sense, too.
I'll be everyone's hero.
You're Enrique Iglesias. You're Enrique Iglesias for me.
I'm not going to kiss away the pain. Sorry. Well, I will stand by you forever.
Well, I'm not Jennifer Love Hewitt, so I...
I will take your breath away.
All right. Well, anything else we want to say about cast iron before we sign off?
I love it.
I love it, too. It's awesome. And we hope you love it, too, as well.
And if it's worth the extra weight, then by all means, take it. If you're car camping, amazing.
Yeah.
Take it with you every time you go car camping. Work with it. Play with it around the fire. But if you don't want to carry it on those portages on your canoe trip, don't care. Yeah. Don't do it.
Yeah.
But if you want to,
do it.
Godspeed. Go for it. You're going to be carrying a little extra weight, but like we said, there's some smaller models. You don't necessarily need to bring the big heavy duty Dutch oven or anything like that.
There's also, and I haven't found a lot of information on it, but just to keep in everyone's wheelhouse, there's also cast aluminum.
Yeah.
There's cast aluminum Dutch ovens, cast aluminum pots, cast aluminum frying pans, which are supposed to be a third of the weight or less of cast iron. Just as thick, just as even heating is what they claim because of how thick it is.
Yeah.
And of course, if you're concerned about aluminum, you got to season this stuff, and seasoning blocks the aluminum. So if you're if you're at all concerned, it can cut down in weight, but I haven't seen a lot on it. Personally, I don't want to carry it for the simple reason that aluminum can easily be melted when you're overheating.
Yeah.
And you're going to be overheating if you're putting it right in the fire full of oil.
Yeah.
There's a good chance you're going to overheat it at some point. So I don't carry aluminum for those reasons. I have one aluminum pot that I take camping. It's the Morris Kohansky Billy can that I've had since like 2009 or 10.
Yeah.
And that's why I've got it. It's nostalgia. It's one of my favorite Billy cans.
We will make a cast iron version of that soon. We will cast our own.
We need to cast our own. We've been casting copper. You was that the first time you saw me cast copper?
No, today? we'd done the other ones before, so. I'm pretty sure.
I thought so. So we've cast copper, we've cast bronze. I guess it's time for us to get into the Iron Age.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll have to build a blast furnace or something back at the camp, and
we're evolving in front of your eyes.
We will eventually get to the space age, and then God help all of us. All right, folks. Well, I want to thank our patrons next, so hold on for that. Well, beyond just thanking our patrons, I want to thank Rye again, of course, for joining me for this episode. I love having my co-host with me whenever possible. I also want to thank all of you, dear listeners, whether you're a patron or not, we appreciate you tuning in. We are at 148,000 plays at the time of this recording, which blows my freaking mind. We're actually on the cusp of our second anniversary of the podcast at the time of this recording in about a week.
Yeah.
We're going to be at our 2-year anniversary of the podcast, which is just amazing to me.
It's nothing to sneeze at for a 3-hour long podcast rather than a 3-minute song.
fair. So yeah, it's I'm very, very, very appreciative of all of you. If we forget to say it, we may the next episode may be a Patreon patrons anniversary party like we did last year. I'm not sure if we're gonna do that this year just for scheduling and everything else.
Yeah.
But we'll see what we can do. But regardless, thank you all of you for tuning in and watching, listening to the show. I know Ryan appreciates it. I know everyone who's involved with the podcast appreciates it.
Of course, I love you guys.
Yeah, we love all of you. We especially want to thank, though, our patrons, you amazing folks that help keep the lights on, cover the expenses of all this stuff, keep Sushi fed so she doesn't try to kill Ryan in his sleep and eat him.
She tries.
She tries. She was growling at your butt earlier. We want to thank people like Martin Goldstein, Srinath, Carrie Beebe, Ian Duffy, Kathleen Leanders. Thank you so much to all of you people and more. You are 101 people strong at this time on Patreon. And if you want to get a shout out or you want to have your questions answered on the air, join our Patreon. Exclusive content. Yeah, we're going into our third patron only course of the month. This is our monthly class is coming up this weekend. And of course, we also have virtual campfires we do every 2 weeks. You have kickbacks that are coming every which direction to help support us and help support you by supporting us.
And as things open up more, we're hoping to have more like in-person stuff too, and meet and greets and barbecues.
We actually had our first one officially when Martin and Chris were here. We had two of you beautiful patrons came out to our sugar bush a couple weeks ago, hung out with me and Ryan for a whole weekend while we were boiling down sap. It was great. It was an absolute blast. I loved it. I want to thank all of you folks. We want to encourage you to join us. So go on over to Patreon, check out patreon.com. You can find Canadian Bushcraft over there. You can, for the price of a coffee a month, you can be supporting us and we'll be supporting you back. It's from the bottom of our hearts, our appreciation holds no bounds for what you've done for us. Thank you so much for supporting us, and keep supporting us so we can keep making this content and meeting more people to bring into the show and go into different crazy things. You do not want to know the amount of plans Ryan and I have for the show for the upcoming future.
Evil laughter.
Evil laughter inserts here. Yeah, insert evil laughter here. Thank you so, so much, folks. We hope you enjoyed this show. We'll see you next week with the next episode of the Canadian Bushcraft Podcast. Take care. Bye.
Bye.